According to the American Sleep Association, between 50 and 70 million Americans have some kind of sleep disorder. When most of us think about the term, we think insomnia. That and sleep apnea are the two most common sleep disorders, but there are others: restless leg syndrome, REM sleep behavior disorder, sleepwalking, even sleep sex. Our guest this morning was diagnosed with narcolepsy when he was in his 20s, and yes, narcolepsy is a sleep disorder. His inquiry into his condition resulted in a book called Sleepyhead. Science writer Henry Nichols has written for Nature, The New Scientist, and he blogs for The Guardian, and joins us this morning from London. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, John. Thank you very much for having me.
I should say good evening.
Yeah, it's evening here.
So your book starts with your own story. When did you first notice the symptoms of your narcolepsy?
I was 21, so that's half a lifetime ago for me. And I was at university and just started getting tired, which in the first week or two of it, it doesn't seem particularly unusual for university, you know, sleeping through lectures, fairly commonplace experience for most students probably. And even when I took the symptoms to the doctor and then they respond like that, then you kind of go away and you think, well, but it probably is just me partying too hard or working too hard late at night, not getting proper sleep, and I'm just shattered in the day. And I think this is probably quite a common feature of most sleep disorders, is they creep up really, really slowly, so slowly that you hardly notice the change in yourself. And narcolepsy, most people will know, is to do with, the main symptom that people know about is that it's too much sleep in the daytime, what clinicians call excessive daytime sleepiness. But there are a bunch of other symptoms, quite a lot, that come with that for various reasons we now understand quite clearly. But one of them is a lot more striking and very, very specific to narcolepsy. It's called cataplexy. And when you start to show signs of cataplexy, you kind of can't ignore it in the same way as you do tend to with sleep. So cataplexy is where an emotion will floor you. It looks like you've fallen asleep, or in fact, sometimes looks like you just died or had a heart attack. In fact, you're probably just laughing on the floor in a heap. So the muscles are paralyzed by an emotion, and the reason it's linked to sleep is because that paralyzed state is the one that our brains insist on when we're dreaming, so that we don't act out our dreams. And for reasons we now are just about getting to understand, in narcolepsy, that pathway is activated by emotions during wakefulness. So you're actually not asleep. You collapse. It looks like you're asleep. You're not. You're, in fact, hyper-conscious, lying there in a kind of a pool of mirth.
But your body's acting as if you were asleep. Is that correct?
Yes. So the body from the neck downwards, I suppose, has just been paralyzed. But the brain is really definitely not asleep. And so that is quite often, or has been, misdiagnosed. Well, it's misdiagnosed far too often for something that's so curious and so specific, but misdiagnosed as epilepsy. The key difference here is there's no loss of consciousness. The person will hear everything that's going on, even though their eyes are shut. You can kind of see what's going on. So your brain constructs all these sounds into a beautiful visual image of your surroundings, and you almost, at least in my experience and talking to others, you have a kind of hyper-awareness of what's going on and what people are feeling and thinking, even though you can't see any of it.
So getting back to your own experience, you mentioned that you first became aware of your narcolepsy when you were at university and you just started feeling tired. The doctor said, Yeah, you're just tired. You're a typical university student. But how did it feel when it occurred to you? And when did you get to the point where you said, no, this is not just me feeling tired. I actually do have a problem. Were you having episodes of cataplexy?
Yeah, so again, the cataplexy, I mean, it varies from patient to patient, but typically the cataplexy would come a little bit later than the sleepiness, and it wouldn't hit in such a strong form because we may come to it, but we now understand that narcolepsy is neurodegeneration, like the loss of just a few very, very beautiful, crucial neurons and one key neurotransmitter in the middle of the brain. But that destruction takes place over a period of time. And so you slowly start to develop cataplexy. So I would notice, you know, I'd make a joke. I mean, the embarrassing thing about cataplexy is that the nice thing is that it's usually a positive emotion. And I think that's probably because they're just much more frequent in everyday life. Much more common experiences just to be having a laugh. But you kind of have to make the joke yourself. And so embarrassingly, it's quite a lot to do with how funny you think you're going to be. And if you get anything remotely like the response you'd hoped for, it's like that's the trigger. It's the anticipation and reward of your punchline succeeding is kind of at least what does it for me. So I'd be making a joke and it wouldn't be funny, and that might actually make it funny if it's not funny and someone responds. But you get a slight weakness at the back of the knees, and maybe just the shoulders slumping a bit and your mouth just drooping and slurring a tiny moment. And in the first instances, it might not even be noticeable to anyone outside your brain. But inside your brain, everything's just going a little bit weak.
We're talking with Henry Nichols, who is the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, and the subtitle is The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. A lot more to talk about sleep and sleep disorders after a break here on the Jefferson Exchange. Nine 21 on the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter. We're talking with Henry Nichols. He's the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. It delves into the really interesting and frustrating world of sleep disorders through his own eyes as well. Henry, we were talking just before the break about your coping mechanisms for these episodes of cataplexy that you were experiencing as part of your narcolepsy. And let's finish that thought, because you were talking about basically social coping mechanisms.
I find them quite enjoyable, but there's a very dark side to cataplexy. You know, they are pleasurable experiences in the main, but obviously if you're having 50 or so attacks like that a day, you start to become very sensitive to it. And the best way to avoid cataplexy is just to take yourself out of the situations that will make you laugh and make you happy. And so actually withdrawing from company of others, it's a very sociable experience. I can't create cataplexy on my own. So it's very much to do with bouncing emotions off other people. And so, yeah, the really dark side is for people who have very serious cataplexy, they don't laugh anymore and they try not to. And if they are laughing, they're actually just acting. So that is the one of the best coping mechanisms, the behavioural change. But that's rather sad, and the psychological damage of that is probably very high, and one we haven't really appreciated or quantified yet.
So also in the popular imagination is the idea that, you know, narcolepsy is somehow the opposite of insomnia. So if a narcoleptic, say, married an insomniac, their children would always sleep a perfect 8 hours every night. But in fact, your narcolepsy was also accompanied by insomnia. Is that correct?
It is correct. And we've actually known this right from the very first proper description of narcolepsy in the 19th century, that narcolepsy is very much about fractured nighttime sleep and to the point which you might be diagnosed with insomnia. So you wake up a lot during the night, but also then at some point you are just awake, rather like someone with insomnia. And this probably explains quite a lot of the daytime sleepiness, not all of it, but I'm in the embarrassing position of, you know, after 15 years of living with narcolepsy, I sort of bumped into someone and she had insomnia, and she didn't know it. We hadn't met before, but she said, I wish I had narcolepsy. She'd had a terrible night. And so it's quite common for... I just laughed at that because I'd spent quite a long time kind of wishing I had insomnia, like the insomnia I imagined. I imagined stupidly that insomnia was this productive state where you had less sleep and you could do more. Of course, that's absolutely not the case. And then narcolepsy really does share a lot with insomnia, and a lot of that frustration of not being able to sleep and not getting proper rest and then being really rather dysfunctional in the daytime.
We're talking about sleep disorders here on this hour of the Jefferson Exchange with Henry Nichols, the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. And you can join the conversation. I'm sure that since the sleep disorders are so common, you probably have some experiences of your own to share. Our number is 800-838-3760. You can also reach us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Henry, some of the stories you tell in your book about the effects of narcolepsy on individual lives are really heartbreaking. I was really sort of noted this story of the French professional cyclist, a bicycle racer, who kept falling asleep or partially asleep while he was riding his bike, and it ended his career.
Yeah. So it sounds dangerous, I suppose, falling asleep on a bike. Pretty sure he's doing what's called automatic behavior, which is you enter this kind of in-between state. You're still doing stuff, and he probably wasn't going to crash anywhere, and he had some level of consciousness. But when he came out of that state, he had no recollection of what had been happening, and that's really alarming to happen. So he was very, very fast on flat stretches, and he'd won quite a lot of tournaments in France at the highest level, on the big, long, flat stretches. Mountains he wasn't so good at, but he competed in the Tour de France and everything. Then he'd kind of, in his training, he'd wake up and he'd just gone down a completely different path and off on a road. So obviously the solution would be to get treatment, but the treatment at the time, the only treatments available for narcolepsy, for that kind of sleepiness, were stimulants, all of which were banned according to the anti-doping legislation. So he was stuck. And the nice turnaround with that story was that a few years later, a new drug came on the market, and this ties up with what we were just saying about insomnia. This is the best current treatment for narcolepsy, and it's a massive sedative. It's called sodium oxybate, and it just knocks you out. There's no way you actually wake up. So it's quite a dangerous drug, and it has been abused. And but it's very effective at treating narcolepsy for quite a lot of people because it gives them that nighttime sleep that they weren't getting. And so he was able to come back like 3 or 4 years out of competition, and win more races. So.
Well, that's certainly a happy ending to that story. So. As you pursued a greater understanding of your own sleep disorder, you discovered an entire area of neurological research and something in our brains called hypocretins. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah. This is a neurotransmitter, roughly. It's a communication molecule in the brain, but it performs a little bit more than just going between neurons. In any case, it was discovered that we only know about it, really, or we only know of its function because of narcolepsy. And there's this brilliant research at Stanford where they bred dogs with narcolepsy and cataplexy, and it was clearly, this condition was clearly inherited from one, it was clearly a single gene responsible for this mutation. a mutation that was being passed down. And then they managed to map it and identify what was going on, and it was the receptor, like the lock for this key molecule called hypocretin. And then this has been a very interesting area of science to study the function of this, because it's right at the heart of the brain in a very ancient, evolutionary ancient structure called the hypothalamus. But the connections and the function of this neurotransmitter, there are only something like 30,000 to 50,000 cells that make this in the brain. That is tiny in an organ that's a billion more neurons. And so in these dogs, because this mutated receptor, that's like having a piece of chewing gum in a lock, and the molecule couldn't do its magic in the dog's brains, and then they were having narcolepsy. In humans, it's different. So it turns out that our receptors are fine. It's not a genetic mutation. Unfortunately, it's an autoimmune attack. So your own immune system goes about tackling a pathogen. It's usually the flu. We know the flu is involved. But for some reasons, in some people, this bears a resemblance to receptors on this population of neurons in the brain, and they get taken out as if they were flu. And so within the space of a couple of weeks, your own immune system has dismantled this pivotal part in the brain. So you have the locks, they're all working fine, but you've got no keys anymore. And so this explains the canine narcolepsy, explains the human narcolepsy. But this neurotransmitter, it has a massive role in wakefulness. It has a very important role in feeding. It has a really important role in motivation, and it has a very important role in mood. So it's playing into many big, big pathways and almost orchestrating them. I think that's probably the simplest way to say. Yeah. So and the way that the science has unpicked these pathways is rather amazing. But everyone who's got hypocretin really needs to know about it and celebrate it and kind of feel fortunate for this stuff, because people without it, like me, it's pretty it's not a nice place to be. And it can influence, yes, it influences the wakefulness, we know that, but more or less in different people, it's a huge spectrum disorder. It will really affect your motivation, so you find it just impossible to do stuff and you don't really know why and you can't explain it. And then it affects your serotonin system, which is about mood. And so depression and all these other things are coming in.
So you so mentioned...
It's very complex.
Go ahead.
No, just saying it's a very complex, really interesting neurological situation. I rather wish I didn't have narcolepsy, but I have found it very interesting trying to unpick and explain and examine some of this science.
And thus the quote of yourself in the book where you say, "I want my hypocretin back."
Yeah, well, that's the kind of upbeat end, because there is research coming. It's taken a long time. So we discovered these hypocretins 20 years ago this year. And the very first response from pharmaceutical companies was not, I'll help cure narcolepsy by replacing hypocretins for these people. It was, I now know this pathway. I'm going to block those receptors for people with insomnia. So I will create a kind of narcoleptic condition, a short-term narcoleptic condition for people with insomnia. The market is just much bigger. So for people like me, that's kind of frustrating. But there is now some quite exciting research and lots of different angles that drug companies developing what would then be an incredibly powerful stimulant, so not just useful for people with narcolepsy, but we might be the first to use it, but much more effective than other stimulants that are out there that people are, caffeine and nicotine that people are taking all the time.
We're talking with Henry Nichols. He's the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of Good Night's Rest. And if you have a question about sleep disorders, maybe you're suffering from a sleep disorder yourself, you can call us at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned the pharmaceutical companies. It seems like, you know, garden variety insomnia has been a huge profit center for them.
I guess that's what you do if you're running a business. You start with the, you know, 10% of the general population will be experiencing chronic insomnia at any one time, and most people will have some kind of experience of it on an acute level, or even periods of, you know, long periods of where they're really not sleeping very well. And actually, and so you would look for treatments for insomnia. I understand that completely. And also sleep apnea then, which is a very common, the next most common sleep disorder, as you mentioned. And we've got good treatments for that. They're a bit cumbersome. This is the one where you put the mask on and sleep with the mask that blows air and keeps your airways open. What was really interesting for me was finding and seeing connections between narcolepsy and these other sleep disorders. So I kind of took the book on at the beginning, trying to cover all sleep disorders, thinking, gosh, this is a little bit ambitious. I know about narcolepsy. How am I going to avoid the problem of having just, and now here's another sleep disorder, and now here's another sleep disorder. And I kind of hope I have. For me, the recognition that all these sleep disorders, actually, they are interlinked. Narcolepsy has so many symptoms to it because of this important neural network that's gone down, that actually it touches on and is a risk factor for sleep apnea. As we've talked about aspects of insomnia with narcolepsy, you get sleep paralysis too, you get twitching legs. It may be, I'm starting to see it as some kind of circadian disorder, so it very much affects narcolepsy, how you see light and you access light, because you've got your eyes shut quite a lot. And so all of these things are usually partitioned by clinicians and diagnosed as one thing. And actually, there's a real blurring between sleep disorders, that treating just one isolated sleep disorder because someone has it may miss part of the problem, because you also, if you have narcolepsy, you quite rapidly put on weight because your metabolism's dropped. You're not eating more, but you put on weight. And then when you put on weight, you're at risk of sleep apnea. And if you're not treating that, then you'll still be tired, even if you're treating the narcolepsy with some kinds of stimulants. So all of these come together, and instead of seeing things like narcolepsy, oh, this is something people often say, and it's infuriating for people with narcolepsy. Oh, I wish I had narcolepsy so I could sleep properly. You do not sleep properly with narcolepsy. You sleep so badly. You sleep a lot, but you sleep so badly it's worthless. And this is where they all come together, these sleep disorders. Anything that disrupts sleep and affects sleep, damages sleep, it's essentially, the outcome is the same. You are in a state of sleep deprivation, which everybody knows what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And sleep disorders, you live like that, and it's pretty horrific. In immediate terms, you're functioning badly on that day, but you're obviously at very high risk of mental health disorders, and then real physical breakdown, type 2 diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, stroke, hypertension, cancer. All of the risk of all of those goes up when you're sleep deprived. So I come to see sleep as really, really fundamental. I mean, I'm obviously not the first person to be saying this, but I think we are getting to the place in society where sleep is, people shouldn't be talking about sleep as if it's dispensable. You cannot. There may be one or two people who claim to be able to have lots of productive hours and tiny amounts of sleep. Do not listen to those people. If that is the case for those people, they are extreme outliers. For most people, you cannot have proper daytime functioning without proper sleep. And to get that proper sleep, you kind of need to, it's not complicated, but you need to invest the time and the effort and come up with, there are a bunch of things you can do, but you have to sort of do them all at once in order to get the real benefits.
Yeah, I used to tell people, just myself, that, you know, I can function if I only have 3 hours of sleep. And but the reality of that was, yeah, maybe for a day or two. But then I start to go downhill.
Yeah, I mean, that is, from an evolutionary perspective, it's a brilliant adaptation that humans and all animals can go for short periods without sleep. It's brilliant, a brilliant adaptation, so we can push it. And it's not going to have serious long-term health consequences, but it's the carrying on with it is not sustainable. The people who are in those studies that where they're being tracked don't make it to the end of those studies. They just die sooner than the control people who are getting enough sleep.
There's a lot more to talk about: sleep disorders, sleep apnea, insomnia, narcolepsy, a whole spectrum of sleep disorders we're talking about this morning with Henry Nichols, whose new book is called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 800-838-3760. You can also send us an email at jx@jeffnet.org. A lot more to talk about with Henry Nichols here on the Jefferson Exchange. After this break, we'll be back in about 60 seconds. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter. Along with me today is Henry Nichols. He is a science writer and the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. And he's experienced what he's writing about. He's been dealing with narcolepsy for many, many years right now. Henry, we have a bunch of calls lined up that I'd like to get to before the end of the hour, but I did want to ask you a question that came up just before the break, and that is, you mentioned circadian rhythms and the role of light that we're dealing with in sleep disorders.
Of course, we're animals, and it is no coincidence that we sleep at night. It's actually quite difficult to sleep in the day and to do shift work. You have to work hard to do that. And the reason our bodies do this is we're paying attention to the sun. So our eyes do not just see. Some of the light goes straight in, not to the optic center and to create images, but goes straight to the hypothalamus, the same part where the hypocretin neurons are. And it informs a bunch of cells, and the molecular circuitry of those cells becomes tied in with the sun and is communicated through lots of neural systems, including the hypocretin system, to the rest of the body. So we become synchronized with the comings and goings of the sun. Because we've got so much artificial light going on, and because we use these devices at different times and during darkness, is a very confusing message for our brains. So I think as a society, we are really not paying We're not paying any attention to the way we consume light. And it is another allied public health concern. So poor sleep is definitely, but allied to that is the way we consume light. We need to be very careful. We need to try to see as much of the blue light at the beginning or the end of the day, and be exposed to natural light during the daytime, and after dark minimize artificial light as much as possible. Certainly the bluish wavelengths are very disruptive at that time.
And those wavelengths come from screens.
Yeah, they do. And the technology companies are trying to put on filters and change the output so that we're reducing those wavelengths, but still quite a lot of the signals coming through will be confusing the brain. The consequence of that is your body clock just is delayed. And so it results in what's called sleep onset insomnia. You cannot get to sleep when you'd hope to. And if that's the case, but you still have to get up at 6 for work, you got less sleep. So you're in a narrow category of sleep deprivation and all those really quite alarming things that come with that. So it's quite important after dark to just scale back on that. And please, people, I know it sounds like I'm nannying, do not take your mobile phone into your bedroom. Do not do that for a couple of reasons. One, it's bad for your health. If you've got children and they see you doing that, they will do that too. It's especially bad for children, particularly adolescents, whose body clock has actually shifted again beyond adults, so they're staying up even later. And if they're using phones, then it's later still, and their developing brains will suffer if you're putting them in that sleep deprivation zone.
Henry Nichols is our guest this morning. He's the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, and you can join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. I'd like to take a call now. This is Ken in Ashland. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. Hi, Henry. Hi, John. I experienced something when I was a teenager. My father was an attorney, kind of a high-powered attorney type, and he was diagnosed with narcolepsy. And so they gave him this giant jar of Ritalin, which is a stimulant. And he did that for probably half a year to take care of his problem. And then one day he came back home with a book on transcendental meditation, which kind of blew my mind because it was very new then, very hippie-ish. And he started practicing on his own. He never took a class. He read the book, and after a while, he felt that his condition was better, and he stopped taking the drugs for the rest of his life. And I was very impressed that he took that upon himself, and seemed to work. So I don't know. What do you think?
So if you really had narcolepsy, I don't want to question the diagnosis, and you have to bear in mind that I'm not a medical doctor, but I do know these things. And if it's really narcolepsy, then he has lost a bunch of neurons, and there's nothing that can replace those completely. But there are a bunch of things that you can do, and you're behaviorally, that will make things better. But they're at least they make sense to me. Things like being very strict about your bedtime and wake time and trying to keep as much stability as possible. Essentially, narcolepsy will seize and parasitize anything else that's going to disrupt sleep, so you need to cut out everything. But even then, I'm guessing it didn't help cure completely, or maybe he had another sleep disorder. I mean, this is not a judgment on my part, but the general point is that society, certainly 20 years ago, everything is just being missed. People are being misdiagnosed or not diagnosed at all. The average delay from the onset of symptoms to diagnosis for narcolepsy is about 15 years. So you're living with this disorder for a very long time. That's average. It's come down in the period, but still, I think it sounds interesting. I'm a little bit skeptical, but that's me.
Okay. Henry Nichols is our guest today. He's the author of a new book called Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. You can join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Henry, we have an email here I want to shoot by you. This comes from someone named Roger, and he says, is there any connection between narcolepsy and restless leg syndrome, or RLS, which I might mention that someone very close to me suffers from as well?
There is and there isn't. So if you have narcolepsy, you're at an increased risk of restless legs and something else called periodic limb movement disorder. But the reasons are because the hypocretin that I talked about plays into the dopamine system. And we think that the dopamine system is what is affected for people with restless leg syndrome. Massively fascinating sleep disorder, again, really, really distressing. I mean, I don't experience it myself, but I've interviewed and talked to people with it, and it's, from where I am, it sounds more horrific somehow than narcolepsy. I'm sure, I've just got used to my sleep disorder, and I'm hating seeing this other one. But, yeah, your legs are in so discom- there's such discomfort and strange sensation inside your muscles that you just simply cannot stop moving. Well, the only way to relieve it is to move. And quite a lot, it's very common, I think, people out there will probably say, yeah, I have that, and they haven't thought about going and seeking help. The help is, I'd say the treatments for it are not great. It's suffered very much from just no research into restless leg syndrome, but there are treatments out there that do work for some people.
You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. Let's take another call. I believe this is David in Medford.
Good morning. Thank you for the topic. I wonder if your guest has opinions on sleep deprivation in high-risk occupations, firefighters, for example, law enforcement, and even physicians in training. And then secondarily, if he has opinions about the need for sleep at different ages, from children to adolescents to adults.
Henry?
Yeah, great questions. The first one first. So the amount of sleep that we need does seem to change as we age, and you'll never get more sleep than you did when you were newborn, or even pre. You know, if you're in your mother's womb still, you're sleeping a lot there, and presumably a lot of brain development is going on when we're sleeping, and then it gradually reduces. And then I mentioned it, or touched on it earlier. There's quite a radical but interesting biological shift that happens at puberty. So teenagers actually need to sleep about the same, roughly 8 to 10 or 11 hours, adolescents, but the when they're taking a shift, so they move about 2 hours beyond what they were doing as in their younger years. And then as you things settle down and the shift moves back, and adult sleep, most people will recognize, and then that's rather stable until old age, and then it seems to reduce a little bit, the amount that you're sleeping. So sleep disorders become more common, and particularly insomnia in the elderly population. I've forgotten, stupidly, but this is one of the hazards of narcolepsy. I forgot what the other question was.
The other question was really about the connection between sleep deprivation and high-risk jobs. I mean, Certainly there are a lot of traffic incidents that are caused by people falling asleep at the wheel or at least being sleepy. And then you mentioned in your book also Three Mile Island and Chernobyl.
Yeah. So I've talked, I didn't even talk about accidents, but you've got a kind of layering of damage that happens with sleep deprivation. And there's the immediate cognitive damage, there's long-term kind of mental health, and then there's physical damage. But of course, if you've got that cognitive impairment, you've got delayed reaction times, and you're possibly even slipping in and out of consciousness, and you're doing a job where that is not great, this is, you know, so there are a couple of incidents like Three Mile Island or Chernobyl and one of the NASA tragedies that are linked to sleep deprivation. So we do have to be really careful. The one that and train crashes, and we need to get better at it and be very on these people and checking carefully and looking after them. And pilots are mostly incredibly responsible and know the importance of getting good sleep. I think all of us, though, especially those who drive, have to get a whole lot more serious about sleepy driving. So if you have narcolepsy and you drive, which is possible if you're medicated properly, you learn very quickly your signals, and you do not ever take risks with those. So you stop, you rest, and you have a set of rules in place that are quite clear. But I think most people driving, correct me if I'm wrong, will get sleepy from time to time, particularly on motorways, but they just push on, which for their brains might be doable because they're not going to flip in and out of consciousness at all like narcolepsy, but they can do. And I think a lot of crashes are probably as a result of falling asleep. I mean, the cost of those, I forget the figure now, but it's huge in terms of economic costs, and of course there's emotional damage that does. People need to really regulate and be very strict about how they drive and when they drive. Do not drive if you can avoid it early in the morning when your biology is at its most vulnerable, at its weakest.
Henry Nichols is our guest today, the author of a new book, Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. And Henry, we just have about a minute left. I wanted to revisit something you mentioned earlier, which is that there seems to be some research in the pipeline that holds some hope for this broad spectrum of sleep disorders. Can you briefly describe that?
There's hope in all these areas. As a general point, I would say there is across the board insufficient funding to make progress, which is not great because these are very damaging. Such a common thing, sleep, that we tend to ignore it and take it for granted, but it's underlying everything else. So we need to pay much more attention to bad sleep, try our best to correct it, and then seek medical help. With respect to narcolepsy, yeah, there are these tiny drugs in development that mimic the hypocretin that I don't have anymore. The challenge for the drug companies has been getting it into the patient and then into the brain because it kind of can't get through the blood-brain barrier.
We have to, unfortunately, end it there, Henry. Thank you very much for being with us. Henry Nichols, the author of Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest.